Our next speaker is Dr. Matt Lisauer, who will be giving us an update on sepsis.
22 slides. 16. Thank you. I have one disclosure. I'm on the Speakers Bureau for La Jolla's pharmaceutical company drug Giapreza, so I will not be presenting any data regarding that. I'm happy to answer any questions afterwards. My other bias is I have a firm belief that systems can empower individuals. I know we're all in some difficult times and the systems are trying to control what we do. I think we have to take that control back and empower individuals to care for the patients based on those systems. And luckily enough, I get to marry that with this talk because sepsis had a huge amount of forward momentum 2016 through early 2017. It's then slowed down a little bit as we've started to digest some of this information. And so I get to pick a few topics to my liking. So as we all know, a couple of years ago, the third international consensus did away with SIRS as part of the definition for sepsis. It did away with the term severe sepsis. And we're left with a sepsis as a diagnosis of infection leading to organ dysfunction. And this is their definition, but it basically says, you know, use the QSOFA. If you have organ dysfunction and it's related to an infection, you have sepsis. And then septic shock, this was an interesting one, right? Mean arterial pressure over 65 with a pressor requirement to get there, or, and I highlighted that, a lactate greater than 2. How many people do I see that are completely normal, tensive, look good, their lactate's 3, technically meet this definition if their, you know, respiratory rate's a little up or their SOFA scores otherwise are a little bit off? But we're here to talk about surgical patients at the American College of Surgeons. How does this affect us? Well, it's not just SIRS and an infection anymore. But do we really need organ failure to begin antibiotics, to do what we do best in terms of source control, to begin fluid resuscitation, which I think we do very well? I would submit that earlier identification and treatment of a surgical patient developing sepsis probably better than waiting till they meet sepsis definitions. How can we do that? Right. So this came out in the World Journal of Emergency Surgery as a little bit of an opinion piece not too long ago. And it basically, you know, says that one consequence of these new definitions is elimination of the concept of sepsis without organ dysfunction. It really says, you know, maybe that's too far and maybe we should look to do that better and earlier. So I would argue keep doing what we do. Right, the new definitions may be good at picking up people who are sick and need rapid treatment, but maybe we can do that in a disease-specific manner when we're first consulted by the ED or if the patients are on the floor. And you know, how do we do that? And I have some slides coming up on that. However, sometimes patients do get in trouble. We're not able to intervene early. They get septic shock. So one of the big topics that's been recently alluded to, and I think fits in with somewhat Dr. Cohen mentioned on you know, inflammatory and coagulopathies, is this PICC syndrome. So here's a quick case. This isn't some of the cases that Dr. Johnson's going to go over, but it's an 82-year-old female. I think we've all had these patients. Status post elective laparoscopic right colectomy for adenocarcinoma. It's just some mild CHF, low New York Heart Association classification, some mild CKD, stage 3. She had an ileus. She was in the hospital a little longer than you expect. But on morning of post-op day 6, the nurse comes in and she's agonal breathing. She's blue. She looks horrible. She calls a code blue. Patient's, you know, resuscitated, intubated, brought to the ICU. You get a CT and, you know, lo and behold, she has an anastomotic leak. I think we've all seen these patients. And the question is, what was missed? In this particular patient, which is a real case, 24 hours earlier, a nurse recorded the vital, the respiratory rate at 28. 18 hours earlier, measured the blood pressure at 99 over 60. That's probably not normal for this patient. The daughter remembers her being very confused at dinner time. Well, that's not normal as well. But none of these pieces were put together to perhaps catch that patient early before they arrested. It makes our job on call in the ICU a little bit difficult. So luckily, the age of artificial intelligence is upon us. And this is where I think systems can help empower us. Some of the first work was done by the group in Florida. They started with a paper and then moved to a computer system where it was a sepsis screen. They used something called the MUSE, the Multiple Early Warning System, SRS, sepsis specific. I don't want to get into exactly what that is because it's all programmable in the EHR now. But there were commandable actions, sort of the effect arm, after a patient triggered. So it's track and trigger and then treat the patient. And they were able to drop their sepsis mortality rate to 14%. And this is specifically in surgical patients. But now we're getting more suave. All of these systems, which I know, you know, a lot of folks that I work with are a little bit worried about, I think we can use to empower us to help patients. There are wearable devices coming to market that more accurately track respiratory rate, heart rate, blood pressure. You're not relying on a nurse to go in, record the vital signs, put them in the EHR, and hope. That patient I talked about, yeah, her respiratory rate was 28, 24 hours ago. The entire rest of the day, it was 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20. I think you all understand what that means. So how do these early warning systems perform, especially as it relates to surgical patients? Well, this was a 4,000 patient before after cohort after implementing an early warning system on surgical wards. And they were able to drop the unplanned ICU admission rate from 3.6 to 3%. Now, it doesn't sound like a huge amount, but in this 4,000 patients, that's 25 patients who didn't need to go to the ICU. So it saves us a little bit of time when we're on call to focus on the sick patients we need to. And there are multiple systems coming out. This is the eCart, the electronic cardiac arrest triage. It's a score predictive of deterioration based on 28 variables collected in an EHR. The data set to develop this was almost 270,000 patients. They missed by one. But what about surgical patients? Well, specific to surgical patients, area under the curve for predicting ICU admission or death, and this was in a 32,000 patient cohort, was 0.8. That's usually where the FDA gives a nod to either a screening test or a diagnostic test. Another one, the VUES L, adds lactate to the mix. We all love lactate as surgeons. Again, area under the curve, 0.83. That's pretty good for being able to track a patient, know something's wrong with them, and be able to intervene early. And this was particular to trauma patients. All right, the Rothman Index, this is the group at Yale. They looked at 26 different variables in the, sorry for the typo, that should be EHR. 12 of these are nursing assessments. So it involves humans. As much as we want to take variability away from humans and things that can be automated or automated, sometimes you need nursing assessments, whether that's level of consciousness or something else. It's a composite score. It's depicted graphically. And in a cohort of surgical patients, again, it performed fairly well. And these are easy to implement with modern computer systems. So AI and more advanced tech is coming. This was interesting. This is off the U.S. Patent Applications website. I don't know if you can see, but there, it's a little wearable. Now this doesn't show up too well, but a little wearable wrist device that measures four or five different things. And it actually is based on an artificial intelligence processor. It doesn't tell you normal, abnormal. It tells you variability and differences from the patient's normal. And so it individualizes how the patient is doing and can give you an early warning trigger that maybe something is not right in this patient. And I think as we get better at this, not only is it going to be on the floors, but companies are looking at how to implement this in the ICU. So you can have sort of a quick early warning as to which of your, you know, 20 ICU patients maybe you have to focus on that night. However, if they do get really sick, what happens to them? Sometimes we can't prevent it. So some other work that came out this year, there's a lot of talk on PICCs and chronic critical illness. If a patient does get septic shock, they have a near 50% chance of developing chronic critical illness. That's 2 weeks in the ICU and prolonged organ failure. These patients do much worse, 32% versus 3% discharge to long-term rehab, 37% mortality. Pretty, you know, so I think there's an onus on us to prevent this if we can. So what can we do about it? Remember the basics, right? Fluid resuscitate, blood cultures, antibiotics. This was all in the Surviving Sepsis campaign guidelines and as part of the bundles, but there was some pushback, right? So fluid resuscitation, the bundles now say in Medicare, you know, 30 cc's per kilo. All right, everyone stops and says, wait a minute, PROMISE, ARISE, PROCESS. These are trials, big trials, randomized trials that came out in prior years that said, hey, if we protocolize our fluid resuscitation, there's no difference in outcomes. A few of us weren't believers, and when you dig through these trials, turns out these patients got a lot of fluid beforehand. A lot of them were done at academic centers, folks were being fluid resuscitated anyway, and even the control group got close to 30 cc's per kilo. So how does fluid resuscitation really work? Should we really be giving 30 cc's per kilo? This paper came out just about a year ago. It's a retrospective look through a 9-hospital system, very similar to many of the ones we work in, with a big academic center and then a bunch of larger community health centers, medical centers, and then some smaller centers. And they wanted to assess patterns of early crystalloid resuscitation and determine the association of you know, fluids and outcomes. And there are some interesting findings. 20% of these patients diagnosed with sepsis never got fluids. CHF and renal failure patients, the fluids came later, and they were associated with less fluids, and we'll talk about how that's bad. This is their big outcomes. It's a busy slide. The top two in each section, so there's in-hospital death, mechanical ventilation, ICU admission, hospital length of stay. The top two slides, top two in each category, show that if you got the appropriate amount of fluid within 2 hours, you were less likely to have an in-hospital death, be mechanically ventilated, go to the ICU. The bottom three are amount of fluid. And if you got less than the recommended 20 to 30 cc's per kilo of fluid, you did worse. So there is an onus to get the fluid in and get it in within 2 hours. So sometimes, you know, despite promise, arise, process, I think there is an onus on us to find these patients early, get them their fluids early. Some interesting findings. We've started covering some community hospitals, and we frequently get pushback from a hospitalist. Someone looks septic, I give them the 30 cc per kilo bolus. Oh, they have renal failure. They have heart failure. You're going to put them on the ventilator. But the same effect existed for these patients. If we give them their fluids early, they do better. Okay. So what about the rest of the bundle? That's fluid resuscitation. Antibiotics, I think we all agree, still a good idea. Pressors, MAP65 for all. I'll spend a couple of slides on that. Source control, I think we can all agree, still a good idea. And, you know, Medicare and SCCM, SCCM started with a one-hour bundle. Medicare's looking at it. Maybe let's hold off a little bit. I'm glad Oscar brought up some personalization of blood pressure goals with the elderly patient. This was a study came out a few years ago, high versus low blood pressure target in patients with septic shock, randomized to MAP 65 or MAP of 80. There's no difference in 30 or 90 day mortality, but if you had chronic hypertension, you had less renal replacement therapy. That's pretty good. And we're starting to get into the era of personalized medicine. This was an opinion piece. It says maybe we should optimize hemodynamics individually to the patient. And some other fluid, this is more blood pressure management on standard versus personalized blood pressure management. They took major surgical patients and randomized them to either normal intra-op routine or targeting the blood pressure to within 10% of the patient's baseline. It was 300 patients that were randomized, and their primary outcome was SIRS with organ failure by day 7. It was very interesting. 51% of patients who had standard intra-op blood pressure control had SIRS with organ failure by day 7, over half. Only 38% if you targeted blood pressure to within 10% of their MAP. I think there is something to personalizing at least perfusion, if not blood pressure, okay, which they are related, to the patient that's at risk. This is the one-hour bundle we were talking about from the Surviving Sepsis campaign. Medicare has taken a hard look at that. And it's all the things we talked about. Measure a lactate level, get your blood cultures, administer antibiotics, begin rapid fluids. But this is tough to implement. If you remember the slide I showed from the 9-hospital system, that the benefit came, fluids could be started within 2 hours. So maybe there's not a huge rush for an hour. And from a system standpoint, pushing the hour envelope may be a heavy lift for a little bit of juice there. So we recommend that hospitals don't implement the one-hour bundle in its present state. And there's a group nationally looking at this to see what's the right time. So stick with the 3-hour bundle. That's official Medicare policy for now. What else is out there in the literature? Quickly in the last couple of slides. Timing of renal replacement therapy and septic shock with severe AKI. My bias before this was as soon as patient was anuric or severely oliguric for a few hours and I couldn't get their fluid, their urine output back up, I was starting RRT. Turns out it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't hurt them, but you can wait to your traditional dialysis parameters to start your renal replacement therapy. Steroids, this is always a controversial topic. There are two conflicting studies recently, one by Dr. Anand. One of them showed a benefit. Now, this was Dr. Anand's study, included fludrocortisone, but look at the mortality there, 49% versus 43%. That's a very sick patient population. The other study that showed no mortality benefit, 28% versus 28%, essentially a significantly less sick patient population. What do? If patient's really sick, i.e. meets criteria for what Anand would do, I tend to give steroids. If not, I tend to be more conservative and hold steroids. The other thing I would argue, and this has been difficult in my institution, which is why it struck a chord with me, I want to get off the saline wagon and onto balanced salt for resuscitation. It's a little more expensive for the hospital, and with our volumes, it becomes a lot more expensive over the course of the year. But I think we get better outcomes, and this is some data that demonstrates that, if we use a balanced salt solution and avoid the hyperchloremia and acidosis you get with normal saline. As people have pointed out, and there's been a lot of talk, normal saline's not normal. Not so new, the Stop-It trial, I think everybody knows, a randomized trial. Shorten your antibiotics to 4 or 5 days after major abdominal sepsis. And that's basically all I got. Sepsis definitions have changed. The guidelines, not really. We're going to reassess the one-hour bundle, and I'm glad there's a trend towards individualizing care, but we can use these big systems and big data to help track and trigger patients. Thank you very much.